Ivor, if you could just tell us a little bit about your family and then your growing up years in here in Alaska.
Okay. My mother and dad, Pelagea Malutin and Cinefont Malutin, were born and raised at Apognak, which is another island roughly 27 miles from here. And my mother's maiden name was Pelagea Lehtonen. Her father came from Finland. And then she also has Russian blood, and also my native. And the Lehtonen is fairly easy to trace, but when we get to the Russian and to the Aleut, for some reason, it's very difficult. My dad, Cinefont Malutin, was born in Apognak. His grandfather came from Russia, and also he was a native. What the blood quantum is, nobody knows, but we just guesstimated 50%, not knowing. Anyway, I'm just trying to think of what would be the best. My mother did got married, and they moved to Kodiak in 1914. And lived here ever since. I have three sisters living and one brother. And let me see, what else can I say? Now getting back to when they first got here. When they got to Kodiak, money was relatively nothing. Money didn't mean anything. Time was, they had nothing but time. And in those days, people, everybody worked with one another. Everybody helped each other. Everybody shared everything. Probably still like a lot of the villages up north. I noticed that when the whalers go out to get a whale in, the whole village gets the whale. And that's basically the way it was here. The only difference I could see that with us down here and the natives up north, and we were exposed to the Western civilization more so than the natives up north, and the Western influence moved in. A good example is my mother Lehtonen. Her dad came from Finland. My dad, Russian, came from Russia. Relatively speaking, I think that you could say that the people that were living on the coastline were European influenced. And only up north, where you have your major streams, were they. The Russians went into the Kuskokwim, they went into the Yukon, and basically that's just where the rivers were, and that didn't happen down here. And they stayed here. They stayed here because the resource was here and they could make a living. And they went up north and they had moved, most of them moved right out because there was really nothing there for them other than just living the lifestyle of the native people, which most of them didn't want to do. They wanted to work, they wanted to earn money, and that wasn't up to them. There still isn't, to this day, a lot of work up there. So that's what made, I think, the people down here much different than the people up north. Getting back to my family, I think that the European influence really, really influenced us, because my dad and mother went to Russian school and they were fluent in Russian. And
was that here Aleut, in Kodiak or
Apognak?
Apognak.
And Aleut was their second language. And by the time I came along, they were learning English, their third language. And it was really funny because every time my mother would talk to me, she would talk in one or two or three languages. Whatever, if she needed a word and she couldn't get it in any one of the two, she'd go to the third one, and usually that would be English. And when my sister, Annie, she's the oldest sister, she's 80 right now, and she, when she started school, she couldn't speak a word of English, only Russian. And same with Moses, he's 78 right now. And Russian was our dominant language. Apognak was divided into two sections. They called that was the north end of the village, and basically, I guess the Aleuts, more the Aleuts lived there, and it was dominated by Aleut language. On the other, the southern end of the village was Derevnya, and that was where my dad and mom and the rest of them stayed in, and basically was mostly Russian. Kind of interesting. Anyway, my father followed the went to Russian school, then he went to training to kind of like a seminary. Mm-hmm. And he was really involved at the Russian church. As he grew older, he was a reader, and he was a choir director, and he wrote songs for the church. He wrote the music for them. And he really didn't have much of a drinking problem, but he did drink alcohol, and because of that, my mother wouldn't let him become a priest. And she thought that would be awful for him to be a priest at. And he stayed with the church. So when they moved to Kodiak, we stayed in the church house right near where the church is, in the same location it is now. And we stayed in the church house there until 1958, when I bought a new house and moved. My dad died in 1954, and so then we moved into another house in 1958. Okay, now getting back to some of the earlier things, I can remember when I was a kid, I was probably about 4 years old, and at that time, I was born in 1931, and in 1935, I'm just guesstimating it had to be about 1935, we used to go fishing out the Buskin River. There was one processing plant in right where the ferry terminal is now, and another one right where King Crab Cannery is now. That used to be Kodiak Fisheries. And in those days, as I could remember, there were very, very few boats that had engines in them. And they used to use oars. And they had a big net in the back, and we'd go out, and I just, probably 4 or 5 years old, just stay up in the bow. When we leave 3, 4 in the morning, we'd go out to Buskin River. They'd make one haul, and we'd load the skiff up with fish. Then we would row back to the cannery. And if there was enough time, they'd row back again. And if the weather was nice, and they'd get another load and come back. And I remember that really clearly. And very few vehicles, well, not in 34, but as I was getting older, there was very few vehicles here. And I could remember later on, must have been probably 5 years later, 4 years later, 1939, when they started building the Navy base. I was still going with my dad to Buskin River, and they were still rowing. And I remember those huge, big trucks that were out there. And I counted the wheels on them, and it was 18 wheels, and I couldn't believe it. And I used to tell my dad, I could not believe that that big truck has 18 wheels on it. And there was a lot of them out there. There was a lot of work. And finally, as time progressed, the war came on, then we couldn't go out there anymore. And just about that time, or even before that, we used to go out to Mission, where the Mission is now. We didn't call it the Mission then. We called it Shahovka. And they have Shahovka Acres now. That was named after that. And right on the outside beach where Norman Sutliff has his cabin, his house, we call that Solomonia. It was a place that was all a nice little beach out there. They called it Solomonia. And we used to go out to Mission, or I should say Shahovka, right about this time, and we had a small seine and we had a boat, a little skiff out there.
Now this is Woody Island?
No. Right out at by where the Salvation Army is.
Oh, okay.
That bay right there. Okay. That's where we used to go.
Mission Bay.
Right. And there was potato gardens from one end to the other. My mother and dad had a potato garden right where the Salvation Army is today. And they had another one right where KEA first plant is, that the Moonies bought down there, International Seafood. But we had a potato garden there. And let's see, and we would go out to Shahovka, and a little old man stayed out there, and he stayed in the barber, and his name was Tikhon. And we used to go out there, and really a good friend of my dad's, we'd go and have tea with him, and then we'd go out fishing, and the Dolly Varden are coming in right now. They should be out at the bay now. And we used to just sit on the beach and just watch, and as soon as we'd see them, we'd make a haul, then we'd get the fish. And if we got a lot, we would row the skiff into town, and we'd put them in tubs, and then we would give them to everybody in the village. And that was the first fish that we would get. Okay, and then later on, I guess it doesn't make any difference, mixed up or not. You could put it in sequence. But anyway, that was probably about the time of the beginning of the war.
Okay. How did that affect, what was it like in Kodiak when all of a sudden this war scare came along? And were you involved in the war at all?
No, no, because in 1941, I was only 10 years old.
Okay.
So I couldn't have no involvement, except just run up to the hills and run to the houses that where we had to go when there was an air raid. And there was a lot of air raids. They had civil defense. The local people were out, and we had to black out our windows. Either you had, most of the people put wooden shutters over the windows so there'd be absolutely no light, or they would put their lights out when the siren would blow. And the civil defense, they were very strict, and you had to comply, and most of the people did. And they gave each one of us, everybody in the household had a gas mask. And every time we went any place, we had to take the gas mask with us. And the houses that lived right by the Russian Church and Standard Oil at that time had designated houses or an alternate place that they had to go to when the alarm would come off because of the danger of the tanks. So we'd always have to go out right where the Catholic, not the, yeah, where the rectory is, the first rectory, where the nuns stayed. We would go there, and there was a little building where we would go right there all the time. And we'd be in the movies on a Sunday and afternoon and sun training, and the siren would go, and man, for the hills we would go. And the planes would be all over the sky all the time. Every time it seemed like we have an area like that, there'd always be planes in the sky. The planes come out at the base. And there was a lot of planes out there. And they had submarine nets, I remember. They had a big battleship come here one time, and they had it on display, and they took the people out, and they had the big submarine nets out there by Puffin Island. I don't remember exactly why. And then they had some submarine nets out here. And my dad was fishing, and at that time, they could only travel daylight to dark. They had to be in before dark. And they couldn't leave till daylight. And they were, the gates were closed. So they watched him. And at that time, there were very few vehicles in Kodiak, relatively none. And everything was just walking, and there were cows on the street, I remember. Fred Sargent had cows, and I used to help him milk cows. He was our neighbor. And everybody had chickens. Okay, the diet of the people in Kodiak, Afognik, and basically the island at that time, the main diet was fish. See, that's another thing that's a little different with the people down here as opposed to the people up north. Basically, the people down here live off the sea. It's not the land, it's the sea. And the people up north live off the land from the hunting, the caribou. We didn't have anything like that. But anyway, we would have a special building just for salt salmon. And they would salt salmon by the barrels, and I mean big barrels, probably, I don't even know what they weighed, maybe 200 pounds, maybe more. And they would just fill barrel after barrel after barrel. Different
and this
kinds
is
of
for
fish.
Resale?
No, this is for your personal use. And then we had potato gardens, and we had, and one of the things about the people living in Kodiak is it didn't cost them anything to get by because they didn't need money because the cannery was here and they could get the salt almost for nothing. And it's all they needed to preserve the fish. And they planted potatoes. And if when they had potatoes and salmon, that's all they really needed. Then when the tides were right, they get clams and they could get whatever else they wanted from the ocean. And then they go duck hunting and then they go ptarmigan hunting and they go seal hunting. They get sea lion, and seemed like they didn't need any money. And they smoked fish, they dried fish, they salted fish, and that's basically all they did. Then when the canneries came in, then they got canned fish, and that was later. Then the freezers come in and they froze fish. So it takes a lot of salmon for one person. And I told the fish and game, when they give us 25 a limit, I said, that's not going to do me any good. I said, I'll just go out whatever I need to get, and that's what we get, and I'm not going to change. Okay, now where else?
One event that I can remember, or cannot remember being here, but remember in history of Kodiak, is the tidal wave. Do you have any information?
Oh,
what
yeah.
was that like? It seems pretty frightening to me. What was it like for the people?
Okay, I was working on We were building Rezanov at that time. I was working construction by then. That was in 1964. And we were driving almost to where the hospital is right now, clearing trees. And then that night, we were all sitting down at the dinner table. I'll never forget it. And just sitting down to eat, and my brother got up and he got himself a glass of water, and he put it right on the table, and he got me a glass of water and put it right there. And I remember that then the house started shaking. And it was a big kind of a rolling. It wasn't just, not just, it was just a big rolling. And so we went outside, and the trees were just like a fishing pole, like just make, like when, if you jiggle, go really fast with it. And people were just screaming, and my mother was trying to calm the Navy people. There were a lot of Navy people here at that time. Just, their wives were just screaming, and she calmed them down. And you couldn't drive a car. You couldn't even stand up outside. So after the first shake stopped, we went down to check my brother's boat. He had a Saner. Went down the harbor, and we walked down the rapid, went out to the boat, and it was tied alongside another one. So we put more lines on it. And I happened to look at the piling, you know, and I noticed that the floats were coming up almost an inch at a time, just coming up really fast. Mm. And I hollered to my brother, I said, hey, we better get out of here because it looks like this water is really coming in. So we went running to the dock, and it was quite a ways, and by the time we got to the dock, the water was almost level with the dock. And when we got, then it started coming up over the dock. So I said, hey, we better get out of here. So we jumped in the car, and I went home. And from the dock, the height of the dock, it must have came up about another 15 or 20 feet over the dock. And the reason I know that is because after, when we went back to work, they took all the equipment and all the Mullins construction crew downtown to start cleaning up. And it was big barges up there. You probably saw pictures of the boats that were all dried up all over the place. And so we start cleaning up, and I'll never forget that. Old Kraft and Son had the grocery store here at this time, and they had a big safe. Oh, it's probably maybe about twice as big as your refrigerator. Probably about 6 feet wide and maybe about 7 feet tall and about 3-4 feet back deep. And we found that about right across from the police station in a ditch, and there used to be a big creek that used to come up there, and the salmon used to come up that creek. And so we got a loader, and we got it out, and we took it back down to Kodiak Motors, but that safe had moved, oh man, I don't know, a couple thousand feet.
That's
up
the
river. Yeah. And everything was intact in the safe because my niece was the bookkeeper for his craft, and after they got the water out, everything was okay. And I remember the next day, Saturday, we went to look for my brother's boat because the harbor was literally just wiped out. There was nothing there. And there was boats on the beach all over the place. There were just boats scattered all over. There's still some of the boats on the beach. And we went all over looking for the boat, and Kodiak Western had a huge building that they used for keeping their airplanes in and working on planes, and the roof was floating out there, just the top of the roof, and we went in the building, and there was all kinds of supplies in there. And I told them, we should just anchor this thing here. And they said, oh, they'll find it. I said, okay. And there was everything floating in the bay, everything, boats on the beach, and it was just horrible. So bundles of lumber lying all over. We didn't find the boat, so we went back. And what else can I say about here? I'm just trying to think of what else to say about it. It really.
How long did it actually take before they started getting in supplies for the people? Were they able to do it right away, or did it take a long time?
Well, there was a lot of confusion, and once they got organized and finally deciding how they were going to do what, it didn't take long. Lumber was coming in, supplies were coming in, going to the villages. No, it didn't take that long. But as far as the buildings are concerned, you know, I don't think there was one building that really fell down or collapsed on account of the tidal wave. It was all water damage. It damaged everything.
I had the other misconception that it actually collapsed some buildings,
no,
but it didn't.
No, none of them. And when we cleaned up the downtown, everybody talked about your house under the doorways and windows is the safest place to be when you're... Mm-hmm. Probably that's true, but if you could get upstairs, if you have a gable end house, gable on the end of your house, that's the strongest place. If you look at all the pictures after the earthquake, every one of them houses, the gables are still intact,
mm-hmm.
and when we were out in the bay, they were floating away. But the rest of the house was gone. But the upstairs was all intact. It'd be like a raft, like a house.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's the strongest part of your house upstairs.
Mm-hmm.